I wanted other people who look like me, or maybe other people who don't necessarily look like me, but they don't look like the super athletic runner, to know that those aren't actually limitations, and that people who look different can actually participate in these events, can actually complete big challenges, and can do all of those things. And body shape and size, age, whatever else, is not really the most relevant thing.
You're listening to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, and this is Trail Talk, where we have casual conversations with all kinds of runners. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultra runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation will go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hey, welcome. This is the Trail Talk, Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, and where we talk to runners of all kinds and looking for people who have good stories and good adventures to tell. I'm Eric Dieter, your host, and today I am excited to have Kath Wallace joining from Sydney, Australia. I ran into Kath when she was following her on Instagram and saw some of her adventures, and I said, I'd love to have her to come on and join in a conversation with me. So welcome to the show, Kath.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Thanks. And so for those of you who may not have, you know, are not familiar with you on Instagram, just give us a little bit of an introduction about who you are as a person and where you're located.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an Australian-based, what I would call myself, an ordinary adventurer. So I have, for probably about the last 5 years or so, embarked on a personal journey that is all about finding massive personal challenges that look totally impossible to me based on where I am at the time, and then coming up with a plan on how I'm going to achieve it, training for it, and finally completing the event. So over the last few years, I've pretty much gone from the couch to completing some pretty big and fun things.
Wow. Okay. So you said just the last few years. Yes. So that's, I've seen your adventures, but I didn't know how you got started, which is why I wanted to have you have a conversation with you. So what was it that, where were you at before? And what was the thing that sparked you to say, hey, you know, I think I'm going to go out and do something fun?
Oh, look, I think for me, I had been, I'm a lawyer by trade, and I'd spent all of my time trying to sort of climb up the professional ladder and do well at work. And I'm also the mother of three children. And I finally got to the point where I realized that I didn't actually have any hobbies. I didn't have any interests. I didn't have anything that I did other than looking after my kids, which is obviously a really worthwhile thing to be doing, and my job. Mm-hmm. And I decided to deal with this crisis in a way that many people do, which is surfing the internet looking for interesting things. And I found a 100-kilometer trail event that had quite a generous 29-hour cutoff time, and I pressed go and spent the money and booked in with 4 months to go till the event.
Four months.
And at that point, just to give you an idea, the furthest I'd ever gone was definitely not running, and it was pretty much walking the dog for about 3 miles, I would say, was the most I'd ever done. And I probably very naively thought, you know, I can walk that event in 29 hours. How hard can it be?
That sounds like most ultra marathon runners. Like we always say that about an event. Oh, how hard can it be? But you had 4 months to train.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So I pretty much I did what I've actually done ever since with most of my adventures, which is I got out a calendar and I worked out that I needed to be able to do 100K in 4 months' time, and I could do 3 miles now. And then I worked out how I would gradually build up towards the event. And I'll be totally honest, I was very, very dedicated to my training, but the furthest I had actually gone prior to the start line of my first ultra was 32 kilometers. which I'm not quite sure what that is in miles.
What, 32 kilometers is right about at the, what is the entry, what we was trail runners call the entry level ultra marathon. An ultra marathon technically is anything more than a marathon. So if you run like a quarter mile more than a marathon, you've done an ultra marathon. But you know, there's a lot of debate among trail runners and ultra marathon runners, like, oh, well, you know, but yes, that is. So you had, that's kind of the entry level, but that's still pretty impressive to do that distance in 4 months. So what was your training like?
So basically I got out every morning and I worked out a route that was about 5 miles. So I used to get up and do 5 mile route before work each morning. And then on the weekends, I would spend the whole day. I just go out hiking in the hills and mountains around my town. But even then, as I said, I got up to 32. So I literally turned up to a start line, needing to do three times the distance that I'd ever done.
Mm-hmm. So you said you did 32K.
Oh, no. So the 32K was my preparation.
I confused the miles versus kilometers. So 50K is the ultra marathon. So I was making the kilometers into miles, but 32K would be, I don't remember. Somewhere around 20 miles.
Maybe around 20 miles or roughly that.
Right.
Turned up to the event and lined up with all of these super fit people who were looking at me and the people who were at the start line, because there were different distances, but we all started at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you had a bib that was the colour of the distance you were doing.
Uh-huh.
And there's all these people looking at me. And I actually had one lady say to me, have they given you the wrong bib?
Oh, my goodness.
yeah.
So how did you deal with that?
I just dealt with it the way I deal with most of these things, which is I laughed. And then I suddenly thought, oh, have I actually bitten off a bit more than I can chew here to think that this is going to be achievable? And I went out on that course and it was a hot day. It was in our autumn, or you'd call fall, but it got up to over 90 degrees by midday. And I was out on that course for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I completed it. I was the final finisher of that 100 kilometres. And I finished it 8 minutes before the cutoff, 28 hours and 52 minutes of continuous on my feet on my first ever ultra attempt.
That's pretty good. So I'll ask what was the kind of things that you went through with your, you know, what were the kind of mental challenges that you faced too? And how did you press through? Cause you really were, I mean, you were relying a lot on your mental determination to finish with, you know, that limited training.
Oh, look, absolutely. So I think that there was a point at about, probably when I got to about that 32, you know, that distance that I'd been before, and I suddenly realized how hot it was and how hard it was. And I went through a checkpoint and I started to hear on the radio that some of the front runners had withdrawn because it was so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the elites and the elites in this particular event were expecting to finish in, you know, something that to me is quite ridiculous, like 9.5 or 10 hours or something.
Yeah, I know. I've seen those
finishing
times.
Those events. And I started to think, you know, I don't know if I can actually do this. And I think the lift for me in the middle was that there was a team that came up behind me and they were doing it together. And they invited me to come and join them. And I walked with them for about 10 kilometres.
Mm-hmm.
And that really turned around my mindset and left me positive and thinking that I would be able to do it. I think the other really hard time is, you know, for those of us who've been out and done, you know, this was over 28 hours on course. When you're out during the night, there's a point at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when you imagine all sorts of shadowy things in trees and your mind starts to really play tricks on you because you've been out there for so long. And that for me is probably the hardest sort of mental moment. But of course, by that stage, I'm so stubborn. There's no way I wasn't finishing that course.
Because you get cooler temperatures in the night, but you also get those, you get those things that, that your mind does to put together things that look, that aren't really there. So.
Oh yeah. And this is Australia, right? So there were all sorts of little kangaroos and wallabies and things, and they were out at night, mm-hmm. and I'd come around a corner and they'd see me and I'd see them. And I'm not sure who was the more scared, but we all of us jumped about 3 feet in the air each time.
So was there a danger of snakes? I know that I was that something?
Yeah, so probably in the day, but to be honest, I don't get that worried about snakes. Australian snakes, even though they're very poisonous, they will go away. Okay. They will be moving away from you. And fortunately, they tend to move away when they can hear you coming. Mm-hmm. And because I'm not exactly light-footed, they can feel those vibrations long before I'm there. And I very rarely see any snakes.
Yeah. The first 100 mile I tried, the snakes at night, we have what they call copperheads or a viper. And they would crawl onto the trail like 15 feet in front of me and stop. And then just kind of like own the trail, and they're like, they wouldn't move. And so yeah, it's funny how the different personalities that, yeah, I would love to, I know that most snakes will move out of your way, but yeah, mm-hmm. these, you know, that event I had several that that did that. So I wanted to, to kind of go back, and you the woman that saw you at the start finish line, and you've kind of written about this as well. And this is something that has, that I have, because I'm not a skinny person. I've been a lot of my life heavy and overweight. So I had lost a little weight before I started running, but still I'm big enough. I don't run fast. I'm a slow runner. And so you had this woman look at you and think, and it was just, and she didn't know you at all, and said, you may not be able to run this distance just because of looking at your body type. So talk a little bit about mm-hmm. that. And cause this was your first attempt, and you had that kind of thing thrown in your face of like, you don't look like you can make it.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me. So you obviously can't tell from sort of this image of me, but I'm a 230-pound woman. So I'm not a small person. Mm-hmm. And I had never, that didn't affect my career as a lawyer. It didn't affect me as a mother. And it never actually occurred to me when I started doing this first event that people would actually be judging me for my size. But I have to say that what I realized really quickly when I started to look around is there aren't that many big people like me out on these courses, mm-hmm. and doing these events. And people like that lady at the start line, they do make assumptions about what bigger people can and can't do. And so after I started doing these events and started doing, a range of multi-day ultras and other bits and pieces of adventurous stuff over time, that's essentially why I started my Instagram page, was because I wanted other people who look like me, or maybe other people who don't necessarily look like me, but they don't look like the super athletic runner, to know that those aren't actually limitations. And that people who look different can actually participate in these events, can actually complete big challenges, and can do all of those things. And body shape and size, age, whatever else, is not really the most relevant thing.
Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I mean, I know most trail runners that I encounter here in the United States, most people are very gracious and, you know, very, very encouraging. And so there's mm-hmm. people who look at you and make those judgments and vocalize them are very few, but oftentimes those voices come across the loudest, because I know so many of us, I mean, men have this as well, but I think it's more prevalent in women. Body image is a big deal. And the way you see yourself is the voice in our head is often more times more of a critic than what you hear from other people.
Yeah. So it does absolutely depend on where you are. So I find trail community, to be really, really welcoming. So I've actually never had a fellow competitor in any event say anything to me that was about my body shape or body size. I mean, I found one of the reasons I do trail is because it's a place where people are very encouraging. People say hello, say good on you as you're going past the other way. Even the front runners will take time to talk to you as they go past. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that in some other sports. I tend to find the people who are really judgy are actually the people who don't actually do the sport. it's the people who are out walking their dog or driving past you while you're out training. They're the people who feel like they have some kind of a right to comment on what you can and can't do. So I find it's not actually the trail community. And that's one of the things that I really encourage people to do when they're thinking about doing trail is saying, look, trail is the place to be because it is such an encouraging community. And everybody out there, I mean, obviously there's elite people and they're fantastic and I'm so in awe of what they do. But the vast majority of people in any trail event are competing against themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to improve their own time, their own speed. They've got their own goals. They're not competing with me or you or anybody else. And so it's almost like a level playing field where everybody can encourage everybody because it's not about places. It's about personal achievement and satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, you know, there's a mindset among trail runners, and it's kind of what drove me as well, of wanting to see what do I have in me? Do I have it in me to go this distance, to take on this course, to face the because you're out there in the elements, and there are so many variables that are challenging. That you have to press through and you have to kind of find it within yourself to push through. And for most trail runners, that's kind of the thing that drives us. So tell me about some of the adventures that you have chosen and what was kind of the thought process behind going out and doing these? I didn't mention this at the beginning, you run you run internationally. And so, I mean, you've done some desert ultra marathons. There's a lot of places that you've gone out and done some pretty epic races. So to talk a little bit about your mindset and what you've been doing with that.
Yeah. So, of course, when I finished my first 100K event, I turned around to my family and I said, I would never do anything like that ever, ever again. and I think within about 2 months, I'd signed up to the next thing. And to me, the natural way to push myself beyond a single stage ultra event was to move on to multi-day ultra. So I started looking at the events that have really popped up all over the world now. They're sort of 6 or 7 days long. You cover about a marathon distance each day. Mm-hmm. And some of them you carry all your gear, and I have done one of those. But mostly for me, because I'm a backpacker, I tend to pick the events that are supported. So carry day pack, they move your sleeping bag for the night. And I just started saying to myself, well, you know, if I'm going to work really hard, then I want to have an experience at least once a year where I can go out somewhere in absolute beautiful nature, walk or run somewhere on my own 2 feet that you can't really get to in vehicles, and have this massive challenge at the same time. And so I started making a short list that, quite frankly, isn't that short. I have a massive bucket list of these events. But one of the ones that I did in 2019, so before we had COVID lockdown, was I travelled to an event in Mongolia, and it's called the Mongol 100, and it's 100 miles, but you do it over 4 days across a frozen lake in the north of Mongolia.
I've seen that event.
Intriguing. So you travel to the very north of Mongolia. It's right on the border with Russia. And the lake there is frozen to a depth of about 2 meters, so you can drive vehicles on it. Mm-hmm. It's a massive freshwater lake, so it's literally 100 miles across this lake. And we basically started at the northern end and made our way to the southern end across this event. And for someone from Australia, you know, it's a landscape that is nothing like anything I could ever have experienced before. The temperatures were cold. The ice is, it's black with these beautiful patterns and designs in it. And then at night, we camped on the bank in the boreal forest with the wolves howling in the background.
Oh, wow.
And it was just the most amazing, almost surreal experience. Mm-hmm. And really cemented for me that these kind of events are absolutely my passion and my love. And I can't wait to get out to do some more of them as soon as we can travel again.
So you stayed near the shore, I take it, when you ran on the ice, but you were near the shore.
Yeah, so we'd sort of go out in like a little I suppose like a semicircle, so you couldn't sleep on the ice because it's World Heritage listed, so the water itself, they want to keep it really pure.
Okay.
So we would go out onto the ice, cover a marathon distance, and then go into the bank and camp on the bank for the night.
Okay. So what was the temperature like? You said it was cold. What was the?
Yeah, it was cold. So the maximum during the day was on freezing, and then at night was got down as low as minus 30 degrees Celsius, which is pretty cold in Fahrenheit.
That is cold in Fahrenheit. Because I know the scale does, you know, the scale goes differently. Each jump is a little bit more in Celsius than it is in Fahrenheit.
Yeah, it is. So the preparation for that event was the event itself. I mean, you couldn't get flatter than going across a frozen lake.
Yes.
But super hard. If people haven't run on ice before, it's much harder than concrete. It's really, really tough on the feet. But the real preparation for it was against the cold. I mean, this was an event with three or four layers of merino and, you know, three pairs of gloves and mm-hmm. Balaclavas and ski goggles and all of that kind of gear. But it was so much fun.
So did you have to, what did you put on your feet for traction?
So we had the spikes, so the metal chains with the little spikes on them.
Okay.
And I found they provided really, really good traction. And that particular event is a multi-sport event. So I did it by foot, but there were other people that did it ice skating or they did it on fat bikes with special ice spikes.
Wow.
So they did a staggered start because obviously those on foot were a bit slower than the others.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so at one stage in the day, you'd see all the people on their ice skates sort of whoosh past you as you're making your way across the course.
Yeah. Yeah. Ice skating would be much faster. I could see you could make some good time depending upon the wind. I mean, if it still would, I mean, you make better that could slow you down. So was it windy? What were the conditions like as far as the weather?
Oh, look, we were incredibly lucky. We had 3 days of really lovely weather, where even though it was freezing cold, the sun was out. The last day, though, was windy with the wind blowing in from the north, sort of out of Russian Siberia, and the wind chill really, really dropped the temperature. And I could mm-hmm. see how difficult this event could be on another day.
Yeah. Yeah. So was that your first kind of international big adventure?
No, I had headed off for a couple of desert events first, because I think when you start looking at the calendar of what you can do in multi-day trail, a lot of them are obviously focused on the Marathon de Sable sort of concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not been to Morocco yet. That event is still absolutely on my list. But I traveled to Oman and did the Oman Desert Marathon. And I've also been to Namibia and done an event across the Namib Desert.
Wow. So what was that? I mean, so that was, you've done that, did that before you did your ice one. So each has their own challenges. What was it like running in the desert? I've seen some of those multi-day events and, yes, there's several of them in those, usually in the kind of the African continent.
Yes.
but
yeah, and they're absolutely stunning. Like I think because I live in a city, so going out to a desert, I think I had a very preconceived sort of notion that deserts were, you know, vast expanses of nothing. And they're not like that at all. I mean, every day of every stage of those events was different, with the colour of the sand, the shape of the sand, even down to like the little lizards or bugs or animals. And I think it was just such a variety of changing landscape. And then the other thing I would say about the desert events is they are so grounding in terms of making you understand that there's this big, wide expanse and we're actually just little tiny people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that's really nice about that, because I think, you know, living in cultures that are very kind of individualistic and focused, is that we tend to be very sort of self-centered and center ourselves. And going out there is sort of an understanding that, you know, the world was there before us and the world is there after us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just tiny little people in that. And it's refreshing and it's grounding. And it's a chance to sort of clear your mind of all of the other stuff that you've been doing all year and really just concentrate on one foot in front of the other and those stunning, spectacular views across the desert when you get to the top of one of those huge dunes.
Yeah. And so are you in sand most of the time? And because that's the pictures and when I see people doing it, there's like deep sand. But I know that it can't be like all sand. There's got to be some places where you can make better time.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously the best photos are always the soft sand bits. I mean, it obviously depends on the desert, but usually in between the sand dunes, there's a flat part that might be give a plain or salt flat or something similar, and that's totally runnable kind of terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sort of the general pattern crossing one of those deserts on a desert event is you have the sort of flat pan where you kind of have it sort of a runnable, you can move a bit faster. Then you get to a dune. And some of the dunes are so high that it literally feels like you're never going to make it to the top. And then when you finally do and have a chance to have a look at that view and get your breath back, comes the absolute best part, which is the bit where you get to run down the other side.
Yeah.
And I'm not very coordinated. So I'm always terrified of going head first down the dune. Mm-hmm. But I'm always very much in awe of the people who make it look sort of magnificent as they soar down the dune on the other side.
Yes. Now, for people who have never, you know, tried to climb a large sand dune, talk about what it was like going up,
the key with sand dunes is that the more light footed you are, the easier it is. So what that means is that the people who can kind of move quickly and let's say they have a lower body weight tend to make it up relatively easy. For people like me who are, you know, as I said, 230 pounds, literally every step that I take up those dunes, I am sinking into the sand probably at least halfway up my shin, like halfway to my knee, every single step. So for me, it's like getting on a Stairmaster machine and just continuing to go on the Stairmaster for, you know, these dunes are sort of 60, 70 metres, so that's like 200 feet up on a mm-hmm. Stairmaster to mm-hmm. get up to the very top. So it is very difficult, and I think if you're going to do it, it's well worthwhile because it's just a spectacular feeling when you get to the top of one of those dunes. But stairs are my tip if you don't live anywhere near a dune.
Well, and it almost feels like the stairs, like it's almost like going up an escalator. That's the you know, you're going up the down yeah. escalator because every step you take, it feels like, well, you know, because you think you're going to be going up, but then your foot sinks and you don't make. You probably make half the progress that you feel like you should be making with the step that you took. Okay, guys, like every step just kind of goes back. And
yeah, absolutely. It's the toughest thing, but the most rewarding. Because when you look down, as tough as it was, you realize how far up those dunes you've come, and the view's just amazing.
So you said you have a long bucket list. What are the things that you're kind of looking forward to?
Oh, look, there's so many. So I have two events that are hopefully going to happen. My event for the end of this year is I'm doing a multi-day ultra across the Outer Hebrides. So that's Scotland. Okay. There's an island chain there, and there's a new path called the Hebridean Way. And the plan is to do, it's the first ever multi-day trail event crossing from the southernmost island to the northernmost. And then we get from one island to the other across the mixture of causeways and ferries. So I'm really hoping that will go, because that Scottish landscape just looks absolutely amazing.
I have seen that. And I've seen, is that where they, fell running is a big thing in Scotland. So is it kind of like that kind of terrain, what they call fell running?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it should be beautiful. And then my 2022, event, is actually a complete crossing of the Caribbean island of Dominica, I think it's pronounced as, actually. So once again, the country has just opened in the last couple of years a full trail that goes from one end of the island to the other.
Okay.
And we're going to run, going to take part in the first ever multi-day ultra across the country.
Wow.
So pretty exciting stuff. And I'm really attracted to doing things that have not been run as an event before. Uh-huh. I'm really attracted to doing first time events, and feeling like that sense of accomplishment that you're the first group of people to complete an event.
Mm-hmm. From Dominica, here in the United States, I've always heard it referred to as the Dominican Republic. Is that the same?
No, different. So it's different country.
Different country. Okay. I'm confused. I am not familiar with where Dominica is in the Caribbean. But so how big is the island? I mean, is it does the trail, it's a multi-day.
It's going to be about a 200 kilometer crossing. So that's about the length of the island.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. I will have to look that up, because most people who live in the United States, I mean, there's been some talk about how bad we are at geography. I have probably better than average, but it was not, I'd not heard of Dominica. So I'll have to do some research on that. So there's another one that you ever thought about doing, a jungle one. I mean, Dominica would be maybe close to that, but I know there's one, I think, is it Costa Rica, that they go across the peninsula?
So I have seen there's a number of really, really nice jungle events. There's one in Panama, there's one in Costa Rica, there's quite a number of different kind of events. I mean, I think the thing for me is that even though I'm really passionate about the multi-day, and I've managed to train and achieve the things that I've done, I also have to be really honest with myself. So I am a backer packer. Mm-hmm. So I do move through these events at, that four and a half to 5K an hour average over the marathon distance day, mm-hmm. including all your just stops and sand dunes and mountains and stuff.
Right.
For me at the moment, the jungle events are probably just a little bit out of my range in terms of my fitness level, mm-hmm. Because they are, they're hot and they're humid, and that takes a lot of energy out of you. The really good thing about the opportunities in multi-day trail is there's such a range of events that there's stuff that's sort of suitable for everyone. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've started to try and do is I've been putting together a website to basically just capture all the range of multi-day events that are available around the world and sort of divide them up by categories to give people an idea of, you know, which ones are good for beginners, which ones are really focused on elites, which ones are walkable, which ones are not, just to try and give people, you know, a bit of guidance, because I don't think that that's really available to people at the moment.
Yeah, because there are multi-day events that are kind of designed for elite runners, and they and you had their the cutoff times are fairly, you know, fairly strict. They're constricting. So the back of the packers, you're very likely you would get you wouldn't be able to make the cutoff, and so. So, that's right.
And I think, and cutoffs are fine. I fully support cutoff times because they're designed to allow people to organize the logistics that are around events. And those things are important. But I think that there is definitely the scope for a wide range of people to participate in a lot of events. And when you look at a whole bunch of them run by a lot of the major providers of multi-day events, they do have cutoff times that are based on 4 kilometers an hour. So those are the kind of events that I aim for, because I train to complete in 6 kilometers an hour. I know that if things go wrong, you slow down, you're at 5 or maybe you're at 4.5, but the ultimate cutoff time's 4. So, you know, you're still going to make it.
So, so what is the website? You said you put the website together. What's the web address for people who may hear this and go like, hey, that sounds like fun. Let's.
So, my website is it's findyouradventure.online.
Findyouradventure.online. Okay.
Yeah. And you can find it there, and, it is under development at the moment, and I'm keen for feedback as to what is helpful to people. But what I really want to do is to start sharing with people, how easy it is to get into trail and into trail events, and how it is possible for everybody to do that.
So what would be your, for somebody who says, hey, you know, that sounds like fun, where would be the place for, what would be your advice to somebody who is starting, you know, starting? It's like, where you are now, if you could go back and talk to yourself before you signed up for that first 100K, what would be the thing that you would say?
Yeah, so what I would say is to start thinking about what it is that you're really passionate about in terms of the kind of event, because I think when it comes to designing your training program and then actually committing to doing it, you're always going to be more committed to something that you're really excited about. So if you've always wanted to walk across a frozen lake or climb a particular mountain or be in the jungle or be in the desert, find a target event that is realistic, but that meets your goal and your passion. And I truly think, and I've started taking groups of people through training programs and to come along to events with me, that pretty much any of these multi-day events are achievable with a 12-month training period. So you can complete a multi-day event that is a marathon a day for 6 days if you are prepared to commit to 12 months worth of training. So I think it's about finding the thing that you're passionate about, because that's what's going to get you to your goal, organizing your training plan, and then making sure that you're committed to doing that, usually by joining other committed people to help push you along the way. And with 12 months, you know, anybody can turn around, you know, as I have done, from literally walking the dog to making my way across deserts and frozen lakes, with just a dream and a plan. And let's face it, a hell of a lot of commitment, because you've got to do the work. Otherwise, you don't make it there.
Yeah, this is not for just a half-hearted attempt. This has to be something real. And again, you go back to that passion, So you know, people who are really wanting to find an adventure and
100%. And I'm not suggesting that at the end of the 12 months you're going to be winning the multi-day trail event. We're talking about people whose goal is to complete the event and have an amazing experience doing it.
So I guess one of the things that I should want to clarify, there's the difference. The multi-day event is you're actually, the clock stops. Does the clock stop at night? for the
So that's actually absolutely what happens. So most the multi-days, everybody starts it, and they normally start about 7 o'clock in the morning. You complete your stage, which is normally a marathon distance, and that takes you however long it takes you. So the front runners will get it done in 4 hours, and the backer packers will come in at that sort of eight and a half hour mark. And then you, you know, sort yourself out for the day and cook your dinner and have a sleep, and then you get up and do it all again the next day.
Okay, yeah. It could be there are multi-day events that the trail runner in the United States where the clock doesn't stop. And so so there's a race series. I can't remember the name of a lady named Candace Burt puts it on. They're mm-hmm. 200 mile plus events. And the one that I first encountered was the Moab 240. So it's 240 mm-hmm. miles. And I believe there's a 4 day, I mean, it's in hours, but it's basically 4 days you have to complete, but the clock never stops. And so, you sleep when you can, and it's a nice challenge, and it's achievable for a lot of people. But yeah, those events are different than
multi-day events. They are. And so I suppose the advantage to the sort of events that I'm talking about is that, once you arrive into your camp for the night, you have a chance to meet the other people, to socialize, to get to know others, to compare your sore feet, to talk about the great thing that you saw. And then you can actually enjoy these beautiful sunsets across the campsite. And it creates this kind of camaraderie that's probably a little bit difficult to explain. But certainly on every event that I've gone to, by the end of the third day, you feel like you're best friends with these people that you've literally only known for 72 hours, because mm-hmm. you have this shared experience, this shared, the shared pain that you've gone through, the exhilaration, the things that you've seen, the things you've eaten and the stuff that you've done is a shared experience that really creates bonds and friendships very quickly. And so over the last 4 years, I reckon I've got a whole bunch of new friends from all around the world that I've met on these events. And of course, now that I've started doing more of them, I run into them again at other events. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like this whole network of trail lovers from around the world. And I've made some of the best friends that I've had in my entire life. So there's really that social aspect to it as well that I think, for me anyway, is really important.
Yeah, and I would imagine there's encouragement and actual help when you're out there. When someone faces challenge, there are other people who are around that can encourage you, lift you up, or help you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, obviously, as a backer packer, often on the first day, I'm usually the only one or one of the slower ones finishing towards the back. But once you get to day 4 or 5, there's always a number of people who were much fitter than me to start with, but they're struggling. Mm-hmm. they're experiencing injury or they're finding it mentally really, really tough. And so the backer pack gets bigger as days go on, and you really do form this bond and encouragement of getting people across the line. And on a lot of these events, there's a long stage, like a double length stage that's on the second last day. And one of the things that I really appreciate is the culture in these trail events, where the front runners will stay up and clap in every single person that comes in through that stage. When they could be going to bed sleeping, ready for the next day, but mm-hmm. no, they're out at the finish line waiting for the very last people to come through and give them the biggest cheer to let them know how much they've achieved. Uh-huh. Wow. And that kind of spirit and bond is really, really nice.
Mm-hmm. Now, the multi-stage events, they're still races. There's still a clock and you get your total time at the end.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not just an adventure where you go out and there is a clock that.
Yeah. So there is, and the front runners, are amazing, amazing runners. I mean, Amman Desert Marathon, a lot of the early stages are about 25K. And the Moroccan runners were coming in less than 3 hours on sand dunes across that desert. And so they are the champions that they are. They are magnificent. And they are rewarded with, you know, amazing prizes and sponsorship and those kind of things as well.
Yeah,
and it's really nice. You know, there's not that many sports where you can be out on a course with those really elite people. And you can have the elite people and you can have me on the same course and the same event. So,
right. You
know, it's I don't just get to be a spectator. I get to compete and be in the same event as those people.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting, you said that later in the race, there were more people at the back of the pack. So what do you do? I mean, you have a fairly consistent pace.
Yeah.
And so you're the first days, everyone else is kind of going out ahead of you. What do you do to kind of keep that mindset of, well, just keep going steady when everyone else, because it's very easy. I know that, when a race starts, an ultra marathon race, there's a lot of people who push themselves too far, too fast in the beginning. So what do you do kind of internally to keep yourself, to put yourself to?
Yeah, look, I think I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I am the world's slowest runner. and I don't think I have a fast pace. I just have slow and steady and I get there. And I think that for me, particularly when I start some of those events for the first time, it's not being discouraged by the fact that everybody else seems to have disappeared off into the distance, you know, and I look at my watch and I look at my pace and I go, no, I'm going to make this. I'm fine. I'm going to do this no trouble at all. And I think it's just reminding myself that sometimes the slow and steady tortoise, you know, still makes it to the finish line. And I have a different experience to the people at the front. I mean, I'm out on that course for a lot longer. You know, if you imagine a multi-day, you know, it's 6 days, your winners are going to be doing 24, 25 hours total. I've done 24, 25 hours by the end of the third day. So the amount of time that I'm spending on my feet, you know, in terms of the time, you know, the amount of calories burned in your body by being out there on your feet so much. I also have less recovery time because the front runners are in, they're in by lunchtime. They've got the whole afternoon to recover and the night, whereas I'm not getting in until just before dinner. So it's a very different experience. And I think the mental aspect of it is probably quite different to the people at the front, because of just the sheer number of hours that I'm out there on the course. And when I do then sort of collect those other people who have slowed down because of, you know, injury or they've gone out a bit too fast at the beginning, you know, I'd like to think that my sort of value add to their experience is keeping them cheerful and focused and helping them to realize that no, they're not going quite as fast as they planned or that they trained for, but that they can still have a magnificent experience and we can have fun at the back. There's no rule that says you can't have fun while you're out doing trail.
Yeah. Well, I am a back of the packer too. And I have my first ultra. I was the very last one to cross the finish line and I've been there a couple of times and it is, there's a lot to be said for pushing through and being the very last one to get to cross the finish line. So what do you say, people who might hear this who say, that's great, but with my life, I can't do that. So how did you restructure your life? I mean, from going to just, you know, your big thing was walking the dog to say, I'm going to run 100K to say, I'm going to go do six day adventure. What kind of things did you do in your life to be able to make that happen? And how did you encourage other people to look at making this happen for themselves?
Mm-hmm. Look, I think the first thing for me was that I think I had made myself believe that people would think I was selfish if I wanted to go out and spend some time for me out doing the hiking and the walking and the preparation and the training. And I discovered that actually that was just in my head. people didn't judge me or think I was suddenly a bad mom or a, you know, a bad worker or whatever, because I wanted to get up before work and go and do a particular run or a particular hike or thing. So I think I had to change my mindset around what I was prepared to, you know, put out there that was important to me and that I wanted to do. And then the second thing really was that I had to talk to my friends and family and say, look, this is actually really important to me. Can you help me? Mm-hmm. And that help might have been coming with me on a hike or coming with me on a run or that kind of thing. But it can also be helping out with childcare, you know, organising some carpooling so that, you know, we're not all driving the same place, so that it frees up some time to reorganise things and reorganise priorities. And it develops a really good network where, you know, I can help them to achieve the thing that they want to do by helping out with their family or their kids or their things, and vice versa. So for me, it's those things, giving myself permission to actually do something for myself. You know, it's, I think I got myself in a mindset that because I was a working mum, that, you know, that the work bit was the only bit that was for me and that I was allowed to do. And I think that's something that perhaps quite a few professional women in particular find themselves in the trap of thinking that, you know, you've got that's all you're allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And it's just not true.
And I think that that women, I think, tend to struggle with that those thoughts and those feelings more so than men in our culture. And that's, it's not fair, but I think that mindset is there because the role is you're kind of expected to be the caretaker, to be there for everyone else, and your needs kind of get pushed down, and to be able to step up and say, wait a minute, I need, taking care of myself is something that I have to do, and I'm doing it so that I can be the best person I can in all of my life.
Absolutely. And of course, I can only speak for myself. But I think in my circumstance, you know, for my extended family, it was a shock that I decided to go out and work full-time instead of being a stay-at-home full-time mum. And so that helps develop the mindset that for some a number of years I thought working was my hobby. That was the bit that was just for me. Mm-hmm. And it sounds ridiculous now that I say it, but that's really where I was as a mindset. So I think it's about changing what you think you are and what you're entitled to. And then the other thing is prioritizing. I mean, what I've really realized the last couple of years is that my work, even though I love my work, is actually not my passion. This adventuring is my passion. And so if I have, you know, a human lifespan to do things in, do I want to spend all that time at work, or do I want to carve out the time to have the kind of adventures that really sort of fill me up and make me feel fulfilled and that I really, really enjoy? And so I have made a number of, you know, career decisions that, you know, mean that I'm not as competitive on a corporate chain or whatever ladder, but I still enjoy what I do at work and I enjoy what I do when I'm not at work. And for me, that's a change that's well worth making.
That's good. Well, thank you a lot. We're right at an hour, and that's where I kind of try to keep these conversations. And so I think that's a great place to end. For anybody who is looking at restructuring their life and to actually make that first mindset to say, you know, I want to have a life that I'm living and not just working all the time. So thank you a lot for being my guest here. I'm going to stop the recording and say you just thanks for being here and sharing what you do. You're inspiring. You've inspired me and appreciate it.
No, thanks so much, Eric. I really, really appreciate being invited.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Trail Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe. That way you won't miss out on any new episodes. If you'd like to contact me, you can find me on Facebook as @UltramarathonMindset, or you can find me on the web at theultramarathonmindset.com. Remember, your mindset is the key to success in running and in life, and developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Hey, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.